So this is part two of our interview with Zvi Bisk. In this segment, he talks about the miracle of Israel, the miracle of Hebrew and the Israeli economy, the celebration of our heritage, and the fact that Israel has three separate scientific technological traditions, European, American, and the former Soviet Union, and the different cultural points of view. And of course, the grand strategic aim at Israel after the creation of the state was to integrate into the Middle East, and the grand strategic aim of the Arabs was to destroy Israel. He also discusses multiculturalism versus cultural pluralism. Please enjoy part two with Zvi Bisk.
And we've turned into Silicon Valley, and we've become a force in the world, and major international companies have built their a lot of research centers here and a lot of production centers and development centers here. Israel is a tremendous, you know, Israel, that it exists, that it's a democracy. They talk about the miracle in Philadelphia, you know, the Constitution. I said, what miracle? There were Englishmen. The first non-English president of the United States was Andrew Jackson, who was Scots-Irish. Everybody else was. They come from the tradition of the Magna Carta, the Petition of Right, the Bill of Rights. They come from a 500-600 years tradition. They had 200 years tradition, 100 years, 150 years of the Enlightenment. It's no miracle. Here we have a democracy with people that came from Pinsk, Warsaw, you know, Casablanca, I mean, you know, Marrakesh, Baghdad. I mean, you know, not exactly lights unto the progressiveness. You know, that's the miracle. You know, Hebrew is a miracle. The Israeli economy is. It's amazing stuff that we've done here. And you know, when you look. I'm one of those people, when I consult with people, when I consult with organizations, I use a methodology called preferred futuring. What does this methodology do that's different than other consultants? Most organizational consultants come in and say, okay, make a list of what's wrong. After about 2 or 3 hours of making a list of what's wrong, there's nothing but negative energy in the room. And people don't even want to be there. And they're arguing with one another. Because if you say this is wrong, then that guy's guilty. Mm-hmm. Preferred futuring comes in and says, okay, what has worked to get us where we are? In other words, you celebrate the past.
Excellent.
You celebrate your heritage. Okay, what's no longer working? What has changed? What are the new problems? What are the new challenges? But at least you've built up this good feeling. You know, one of the problems in Israel today is this tremendous melancholy, pessimism, malaise. I mean, and it's hard not to when you look at our leadership. I mean, my God, you throw up, you know. But still, it's like, even with this, the country's going, we just had a war, and we grew 4.5%, and we lowered our national debt vis-a-vis our GNP.
Unbelievable.
And in the middle of a war. And they're investing in us. We just had this, the biggest Chinese software company just invested in Israel now. China's investing in Israel.
We just had a young entrepreneur and venture capitalist here. A good friend last night, Guy Hirsch. What was asked was, what's going on here with this generation of entrepreneurs? He said, the key thing here where Israel stands out from the rest of the world is that we have the passion, they have the desire and creativity to break boundaries.
Yes.
And he says, in this sense, we become a light to the world, in terms of economics at least. He says, it's unbelievable. And as a result, we're reaching out into areas that
nobody else touches.
No one else will touch.
Also, there's another thing.
It's exciting.
We have three separate scientific technological traditions here. We have the European, we have the American, and we have the former Soviet Union. And they're all combined. And they all sit in the same room. I have a small translation company. I'm telling you, within walking distance of my house, there's 60 languages being spoken. You know what I mean? It's like the intensity. Here, our small size is an advantage. Less is more in this case. You see, mm-hmm. you can have ten business meetings a day in this country. You can't do it in the United States. You can't do it in Europe. You can get things done very quickly here.
Yes,
very quickly. And there's this unmediated relationship.
That's
too.
The drivers I was telling you about. I drive a scooter in Jerusalem, uh-huh. And people drive like, you know, if they get there 30 seconds later, it's the end of the world.
Yeah. Here's actually, well, this is negative. But in general, there's this positive inheritance we've gotten from being Jewish. For example, I was once analyzing the Israeli-Egyptian peace process. And the Israelis were always complaining that it's very slow. We made peace with them, and we still haven't developed this, and we haven't
cold
done this,
peace.
Cult, you know, cold peace, right. And this, that, you know. I said, look, you have to look at it from a cultural point of view. A Jew gets up in the morning in Europe in the 19th century or the 20th century and says, what, I'm still alive? Mm-hmm. It's a miracle. So I got to get everything done today, because tomorrow I could be dead. The Egyptians grew up around the Nile. The Nile went, it's going, it will go, there's time. It's a different attitude towards time. For them, they think it's very fast. They think, their perspective, their narrative, it's a word I hate, by the way, but their narrative of the peace process is totally different than ours. We say it's slow. We went already, you know.
We want to hug each other already.
Yeah, no,
hey,
we
get on
want,
with it.
No, come on, let's go. And that was the mistake we made also with at Camp David. You know, and I blame myself too because I supported Barack at the time. But now I realize it was a mistake. We move at a glacial pace. There's an asymmetry here, fundamental. The grand strategic aim of Israel after the creation of the state was to integrate into the Middle East. The grand strategic aim of the Arabs was to destroy us. That's not a symmetrical thing.
No.
You know, so the very fact that we're having a peace process is a victory for us and a defeat for them. So you want more than that? Another 50 years, it'll be a little more. Another 100 years, it'll be a little more. The Germans and the French still hate each other's guts. They're both right. But, you know, when Ben-Gurion was prime minister, this country had 1/1,000,000th the power it has today. I had the opportunity twice in my life to sit with David Ben-Gurion. It was before I even spoke Hebrew because he died in 73. And the first time I sat with him, he asked me if I had any questions. So I said, yeah, what is the major job of a leader? And he immediately said, educator. I said, educator? He said, yeah, you have to educate the people to what the main problem is, not the marginal stuff. Then you have to educate them what has to be done to correct that problem. Then you have to talk about how to do it. Then you look at a collection of Ben-Gurion speeches. Almost every single speech, he defines a problem, tells you what has to be done, what we have to do to do it. So that he's focusing energy. It's like a hose. He didn't have much water coming out of the hose, but he squeezed it and he focused it. And people got up in the morning in the 50s, even though they were getting 6 olives a day and 1 hard-boiled egg or whatever it was, and they knew what had to be done, more or less. I'm romanticizing, exaggerating. But you knew what had to be done. You had a leadership that defined what the problem was. You had an opposition that said, no, he's wrong. But at least the opposition knew what they were against and what they were for. I mean, there was clarity. Today, it's like we have 1,000,000 times more water, but it's like spritzing out all over the
everywhere.
Place. It's not focused.
No.
And that's the job of a leadership, is to focus that. Israel's a powerful country. It's a small country. Economically, we're not a country. Economically, we're a city. Israel's a city-state, you know, 6 million people. It's less than greater Boston, greater San Francisco, greater Philadelphia, you know. And that's the way we should look at ourselves. But culturally, militarily, politically, we're a country.
You mentioned you have a chapter in your book on that separates multiculturalism from
cultural pluralism.
Right.
Yes.
Maybe could you explain the difference?
Well, as I understand it, I'll explain the difference. Okay. Multiculturalists say there is no hierarchy of values. All cultures are the same, and cultures are constructs. So that's what, you know, postmodern deconstructionism. They deconstruct, you know. So that there is, you know, no culture is inherently morally superior, you know, so, and you carry that to its logical conclusion, that you can say, well, democracy is not morally superior to fascism, you know. And I think that's ridiculous. I think there is a hierarchy of values. I think cultures that cut off the hands of thieves are inferior to cultures that don't cut off the hands of thieves. I think cultures that have the death penalty, apropos the United States, are inferior to countries that don't have the death penalty. I'll play it both ways. I think countries in which women are recognized as equal human beings and are striving systemically and systematically to improve the status of women are superior to countries that murder teachers, or cultures that murder teachers who teach women how to read and write, which is happening in Afghanistan again with the Taliban. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think there's a hierarchy of values, and I think there's a lot of, you know, and multiculturalism is an ism, it's an ideology. So there's no hierarchy of values. I'm sorry, there is. But cultural pluralism is like, okay, you're Italian, you eat pizza, you're Jewish, you eat gefilte fish. That's great. We're going to eat Chinese today, we're going to eat, you know. But look at America. Believe me, the Polish Catholic immigrants to America did not want to recreate in America what they had in Catholic Poland. You know, the Sicilians and the Neapolitans did not want Southern Italy when they came. They wanted America. Now, they still wanted their food. They still wanted their music. That's fine. That's great. That's enriching. That gives different perspectives. As a matter of fact, once a couple years ago, Fortune magazine had this article about the various scientific centers in the United States and economic centers, the centers of economic dynamism. And they had 10 items. And one of the items was the percentage of immigrants. Where there's a higher percentage of immigrants, there's a higher percentage of dynamism. Now, when you think that almost 50% of the PhDs in Silicon Valley are either Chinese or Indian, you can understand that. Mm-hmm. Maybe another 5-10% are Israeli. You know, I mean, immigration is dynamic. You know, pluralism is good. You don't have this uniform, one-dimensional view of life. You have a mixture of views. But that doesn't mean that every culture is equal or every value is equal. That's nonsense. That's dangerous. That's also racist because it offers an excuse for undeveloped countries to continue to be undeveloped. Well, it's their culture. We don't have a right to interfere. It's nonsense. Yes, we do. We have an obligation to interfere.
So in that context, one of your chapters is why be Jewish?
We have to invent a reason. It's the only thing I agree with the existentialists about, that we invent reasons for living. We have to invent a reason. My book is written mostly for non-Orthodox people, let's face it. In the author's questionnaire, I said the market is the university educated non-Orthodox Jew. Because Orthodox people don't ask that. It's a given. And very few other people, nations ask that question. Nobody asks, why be a Canadian, or why be a Frenchman, or why be a Basque, or why be a whatever, They don't ask that. Jews ask it. So it's a rhetorical question, and I offer what might be possible solutions. Now, a lot of people won't come. So if a lot of people assimilate out, they assimilate out. And some people will assimilate in. We're an open society. Guess what? And whenever we get neurotic about this and try to close ourselves off, we just alienate more. You tell your kids not to date a Shiksa, sure enough, they'll go date a Shiksa. Just to make you angry. What was that Jewish joke that I heard that, in the 60s, a son comes to his mom, I want to get married. Is she Jewish? In the 70s. Mom, I want to get married. Is she white? In the 80s. Mom, I want to get married. Is it a goyel? humor has a lot of insight to it, If you're open, you'll survive. If you're dynamic, you'll survive. If you become fossilized, as Toynbee said we were, and we're not, if we fossilize ourselves, then we'll die. These people that have absolutist definitions of what is authentic Judaism, a lot of people in this country use the term, is authentic Judaism. That means that everybody else is non-authentic. What's that supposed to mean? That's an arrogant way of looking at it.
See, you say in one of your chapters, I'm just going to quote, being a Jew means to feel oneself a part of a community. Jewish identity and Jewish community are, for many, one and the same. Certainly, significance of a community is a fundamental value of Judaism.
Yeah. I would say 90% of the people that belong to the Reform and Conservative synagogues in the United States are not even religious according to Reform and Conservative definitions. They belong to it as an ethnic way. That's what you do if you're Jew, if you want to be involved in the Jewish community, especially in smaller communities. You have a higher percentage of synagogue membership in Baltimore and Cleveland than you have in New York. Mm-hmm. Because in New York, you just walk out in the street, you're Jewish. The whole subculture of New York is Jewish. That was driven home to me in the 80s. I was back in the States on a visit. I turned on the television, and there's this black weather woman giving the weather. And she says, well, weather wasn't too good today. It's been spritzing all day long. I said, yeah, God.
Oh, that's good.
I can't make that up. I'm not that clever. New York, you do have a lower percentage because New York is Jewish. But Baltimore or Cleveland or Atlanta or, Memphis, Tennessee. Have you ever been to Memphis, Tennessee?
No, but I know some Jews from there.
My God, that's the most Jewish place in the world.
Yes.
I had a story. I went there. I had to give a parlor meeting there. And I woke in, this is if your listeners haven't been there. Memphis, Tennessee has got Jesus Saved on its gas pumps. It's got, this is the most goyish place in the galaxy. They have the biggest Orthodox shul in the country, the Baron de Hirsch synagogue, I think it's called, the Hirsch synagogue, I don't know, whatever it's called. They have a kollel, they have two kosher restaurants. So I'm invited to this parlor meeting, and people start coming in, and this guy walks in, this like Chabadnik with the tzitzis and and everything else hanging out, and the black and the whole thing, and he looks at me and goes like this, you all here for the parlor meeting? I said, man, people that look like you don't talk like that.
You've never seen a Yankee?
People that look like you do not talk like that.
That's great.
I felt, you know, I felt like I was in, you know, Living Mad magazine.
You also mentioned about the diaspora reasserting itself and its relationship to Israel in a new context. You want to speak a little about that?
There's been some debate now, because I thought that Israel now has more Jews in it than American Jewry, but now there's a new thing coming out that is still more American Jews.
Brandeis.
And I say, so what?
Yeah.
There are more Jews in Israel than there are Danes in Denmark, Irish in Ireland, Finns in Finland, Norwegians in Norway, and they don't bitch about population and immigration and demographics. And they have a pretty good standard of living and pretty good cultural life and a pretty good, you know. So I say Neo-Zionism has to be concerned with preserving the diaspora. And the only reason that way that can happen, now look at the American diaspora. Most of the exciting things happening in Jewish life today are happening in the American diaspora. Talk about the Reconstructionists, you talk about the Chavurah movement, you talk about things that are happening within conservatism and reform, things that are happening within Neo-Orthodoxy, with women minions. That are not happening here. The humanistic Jews, I think that's a coming thing. It's an exciting time in American Jewry. And we've become a negativity for that, because you still have this Israel, this Middle Eastern thing on your back. We're no longer net positive. We have a lot of negative on Jewish life. And I rather than the diaspora being an auxiliary to Israel's social needs, which I think is really just gives us an excuse not to do the efficiencies which are required, you know, and lets little corruptions take place because we can always raise money and to
fill the gap.
All diaspora contributions put together, including bonds, which is not a contribution, is maybe 1% of Israel's GDP. It's garnished, and yet we are devoting all that energy. So I say, let's build projects that are multidimensional, that answer several needs at once. And apropos energy, I say, okay, let's. You know, if I was an American Jew, this is what I'd form an organization that would buy gas stations. And this organization would then set up a sugarcane plantation in some poor country in Latin America. Let's say the Dominican Republic. And we get together with the local Dominican. Why do I say sugarcane? Because sugarcane produces 8 times more ethanol power, energy, per invested unit than corn ethanol. Now, that plantation will also have a boarding school for AIDS orphans. That plantation will buy its fertilizers, insecticides, or agricultural equipment, irrigation equipment from Israel. Now, what are you doing all at once? You're attacking the major, what I call, grand strategic challenge to the West today, which is energy. You're developing good relations with the Hispanic community. You're helping poor people in the third world. You're helping the environment. You might even take the profits you make for your gas stations and invest it in getting inner city people off the grid, putting fluorescent lighting in, insulating them, whatever. So I call it multidimensional. Everybody benefits. And you're on the side of the angels in every aspect of it. Rather than, got to raise money for Israel. No, I want all the money to stay there. But all things being equal, buy Israeli products. Now, that also leaves room for activity for people who are not rich. You know, the movers and shakers are people who are rich. Well, that's not 90% of the Jewish people, I'm sorry. 90% of the Jewish people are at best middle class. And they're struggling to make ends meet. Especially if they got a kid in college or 2 kids in college. Especially if they've had a health crisis recently. So, you know, say you got 2 kids in college and you've had a minor heart attack. I got news for you. You're not a mover and shaker in the Jewish community. Well, I'm sorry. That's not Jewish community. And that's because Israel has created this Israel diaspora relationship, which is focused on fundraising, which I don't knock. It served its purpose. It was wonderful. It's beautiful. It's still good, but you got to change it. I talk about something called the $1,000 Club. What is $1,000? I have a small translation company in order to make a living. I think I make a living out of being a futurist. What are you kidding? You know, what do I mean? Okay, so I have a cousin. She's a secretary for a lawyer. So she contributes $25 a year to the federations lose money on those kinds of contributions. No. Why don't you sell translation services? You'll get 10%. I want to give you a 10% commission. I don't want you to do it for free. I want you to make money on it. If you've made $1,000, that means you've sold $10,000 worth of Israeli services. You've contributed $10,000 to the Israeli economy. As a matter of fact, since it's in the private sector and not to the public sector, $10,000 in the private sector is equivalent to $15,000 in the public sector in terms of its efficiency in creating jobs and dynamism. All the economic research shows that. And so you can be a bus driver, you can be a cab driver, you can sell non-tangible services that Israel could Because now you got the internet, you see. I sell my services in an attachment. I don't need a ship or a plane. It's an attachment. I press enter and it goes. You know, they press enter and money's transferred. That's what I talked about previously. What futurism does is, okay, these are the realities, and this is the kind of Israel-diaspora relationship we could build on the basis of those realities. Now, that way, I can get much greater number of people involved, and all of a sudden, the woman says, yeah, I contributed $15,000 to the Israeli economy. That doesn't mean she's signed. She made $1,000. She's paid for a vacation. I come from Philadelphia. Philadelphia is a group of people called the Quakers, and they used to have a saying of doing well by doing good. I say no. I say doing good by doing well. I'm Jewish. I go right to left. You know? And that's the kind of thinking that a futurist should be dealing with, you know. Shlilat gola, negation, you know, in the book I read, it's got to be the dumbest ideological principle. You know, all these other countries that I talk about, the Irish, the Finns, and the one thing that they don't have that we have is a vital diaspora concerned about us. It's one of our greatest grand strategic resources, and our ideology is to negate it. Is there anything so irrational in the history of the human race? It's ridiculous. Now, ironically, it's not a win-lose-lose-lose. It's a win-win. A dynamic diaspora in interaction with a Israel whose standard of living is constantly going up will get more aliyah. We'll have less yirida.
Just inherent in its own success.
Yes. It's like self-evident. It's like, hello? If we become part of the global economy, we have 6 billion. Our domestic market is today, if you're talking about globalization, our domestic market is 6 billion, not 6 million. Especially when you're talking about, you know, non-tangible services, which is our future, in my opinion. Certainly not heavy industry. I mean, mm-hmm. It's never going to be heavy industry. And who the hell wants heavy industry? Who the hell wants to work in? It's boring. I worked for a year in a textile factory when I was in university in the United States. Most boring job I ever did in my life.
Yeah, I worked in the pill factory in Boston, Somerville, factory. That was so boring.
And
just
then I
got
came
married.
To Israel and I said, oh, I'm going to work in agriculture. I was with this Tolstoyan Aleph Dalet Gordon thing, you know. I worked 2 months doing this agricultural work, and I said, Gordon was wrong.
Backbreaking work.
My IQ was dropping. I was beginning stupid.
I was there.
Backbreaking, fine. I was in good shape. I was schwitzing. I felt good. You know, there was a lot of girls there. It was nice.
Intellectually
stimulating. But duh.
I think it was Lenin who said, farming dulls the mind.
Oh, yeah, Marx hated peasants. Yeah, the classic Marxism hated peasantry. He thought they were morons. No comment. If you weren't one before, you will be after.
Listen, I worked for 2 years in the kibbutz with the turkeys. You talk about...
They're the filthiest animal.
Unbelievable.
The
stupid.
Stupid.
How they survive?
They're worse than chickens.
I had to, you know, are, every morning I had
disgusting.
To go in there and separate them from killing each other.
Disgusting.
And then I put all the weak ones in one cage, and wouldn't you know that they were pecking each other to death there, too.
They're so stupid they can't even find water without by themselves if you don't put
right. Something
in the water that, you know, stimulates them to check it out.
Unbelievable.
I don't know.
How do they survive in the
so
wild?
So this whole thing, this, you know, apropos Zion, apropos changing your view, there are people who still claim we still have to have agriculture in Israel because that's Zionism. I say, wait a minute, let's analyze it. We're one of the 17th driest countries in the world in terms of cubic meters of water available per citizen.
A lot of water.
So what we're doing, when you export agricultural produce, you're exporting water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Israel is now subsidizing the export of water in order to create jobs for Thai workers. And we call it Zionism.
That's great.
And I'm saying this, I don't get it. It does not make sense. But Zionism, I heard a very famous, I'm not even going to mention her name, because if Israel has to import tomatoes, it's the end of Zionism. And I said,
tomatoes, Zionism?
Why? Let the Egyptians grow tomatoes. We'll buy it from them. We'll sell them computer chips. That's a better deal. It's more interesting work to make computer chips than to grow tomatoes. I've grown tomatoes. It's then you get a greater appreciation for the bourgeois way of life. Yeah. Be a peasant for a week. End of story. Or have a toothache. No, before I came to Israel, I hitchhiked through North Africa. And North Africa, this is 67. North Africa at this time was in its pre-industrial phase, which I imagine it still is, as a matter of fact. And I saw what dental care was in Morocco. You went to the Shouk, and there was these 10 old guys with pliers, a tin, a bucket, and a bottle of water. And people would sit in the chair and point at a tooth. They'd pull out the tooth, you drink the water, and you'd spit it out, and then you get up. And that was dental care. I like Novocaine. I'm big on it. Pain is not my thing.
And for the future.
Yes.
So your last chapter is facing the future towards 2040.
Yeah, well, see, what you did explain was what we were talking about is I'm writing from the perspective of 2020.
Right.
Up until now. So now that we've accomplished all this.
Thank you.
And we are now expanding demographically, and we are now physically secure. And
interacting everything between the diaspora.
And we have peace, and everything is fine, because there's a chapter in there about called practical peacemaking rather than ideological peacemaking, how to go about it. Okay, so what next? So it's like, so what? In my first book, the end of that chapter was, the subheading was called, so what? Now what do we do? So I think our entire last 3,000 years of Jewish history is nothing but the introduction to the writing of the novel. Now we got to write the novel. Judaism and Jewish identity and Jewish individuals who attract us, who are exciting in history, whether it's Jewish culture in general with monotheism or Jewish individuals such as Einstein and Freud and whatever, are people who are always touching the nerve endings of what is bothering the entire human race. The Jews cannot be a nation like every other nation. Otherwise, we won't be Jewish. You see, there's a contradiction here. We can be a nation, and we must be a nation like every other nation in terms of our clothing. We need a state. We need an army. Fine. I'm a nationalist in that sense. But to be satisfied with Finland, and nothing wrong with Finland. I mean, you know, the Finns like it. They don't smile a lot, but they like it, you know. So it's like, so what? Have we, you know, it's like I used to say, we've gone through 3,000 years, called through 3,000 years of the muck of history just to have good fundraisers and good fighter pilots. I mean, there's something wrong here. We've confused the ends and the means. And I really think that the Jewish people as a culture have to have transcendent aims. What they are is a different story. I have my own shtick. I didn't include it in this book. I included it in the other book. Mm-hmm. But I took it out. Fill in the blanks. Ken yirbu. You know, let it multiply. But if it's not a religion per se, Judaism, Jewish identity, Judaism as a religion, yeah. If being Jewish is a fellowship, is a commonwealth, is a community, and it's something that drives anthropologists crazy and sociologists crazy, they still don't know what to do with us. Some anthropologists say, well, there's no such thing, you know. So for having no such thing, we're really in the news a lot, I'll tell you that. You know, we don't exist. Okay, so I get past that. What does unite all of Jewish, the good Jewish gestalt, the Jewish spirit, the Jewish emotion, the Jewish passion, is to always be at the forefront of something. Always be on the edge. I took it out of the book, but I said, we're the pain in the ass people.
Yeah, we are the edgy people.
We're the edgy people.
We really are.
And we make people nervous.
Drive people nuts.
We drive, we're, but that's what makes us interesting, too. And I don't want to give that up. I don't want to be normal. I don't want to be dull. Mm-hmm. I like that edginess. That's being Jewish. That's that fun. That's that quickness. That's that sharpness. I once had a neighbor who was an Irish Catholic who had married an Israeli woman. And one day we were having a conversation. He said, you know, since I'm living in Israel, I know for a fact that Jews are not smarter than other people. I said, yeah, that's...
You learn that fast.
I said, you know, that's one of the great triumphs of Zionism, that it's ended that racist canard that the Jews are smarter than other people. We're just as dumb as everybody else, believe me, maybe dumber. So I said, yeah, I agree with that, Tommy. And then he says, but I understand what the difference is. The Jews have... And he used the Hebrew word pilpil. It's a pilpil. It's different than other people. He says, you're definitely not smarter than anybody else. Watch people drive, and you know that, you know. But the pilpil has to be more than just, you know, Jackie Mason jokes, although that's part of it. You know, stand-up comedy is part of it. Stand-up comedy, like, what, 70% of the stand-up comics in the United States are Jews? And Robin Williams grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. You know, he was once on television, he said, I went to so many bar mitzvahs, he says, I saw more melting ice than the Titanic. That was only the Jews laughed at that because they were the only ones that understood the joke. He understood it. Or Eddie Murphy. Would you ever see that movie when he was playing the African prince?
And he comes up,
yeah. Well, there's this scene in the barbershop that they're back and forth.
Yeah.
And he plays all the parts. He also plays the Jew. And he has the greatest Jewish joke of all time with a tremendous Yiddish accent. And when I tell people it's Eddie Murphy, they say, no, I can't. Well, he grew up in Brooklyn. So that edge, that humor that I wanted, what, it's like less than 1%, 0.1% of the population. It's like 30% of the Nobel Prizes in science. That doesn't mean we're more intelligent. It just means we see things different. Let me tell you a story, an anecdote. I'm in the American Army. And one of my best friends in the American Army is an Italian boy from Brooklyn named Bobby Prado. Never forget it. He says, you ever been to Brooklyn? I said, yeah, my father used to take me up to visit a guy we called Mr. Schumann. Mr. Schumann sold feathers. This is when they had feather dusters. My father was so brilliant, you know. And, of course, the people who raised feathers were Jews in Texas that had ostrich farms. I says, that's what Mr. Human made his money out of? I says, no, his big money was made out of used feathers. So this guy, Bobby Prado, starts laughing hysterically. tears are coming down his eyes. I said, what's so funny? He says, look, don't get me wrong. You know I'm not anti-Semitic. You know, I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. He says, but only a Jew would know how to make money out of used feathers. So I said, I was like at a loss. I said, it's a good business. He said, he starts laughing again. He's hysterical. I'm sure it's a good business. But only a Jew could think out of making a living out of used feathers. And I thought about it. And I grew up in a family where said, look, as long as you make an honest living, whatever you do, that was our dinner table conversation. I'm sure you had the same thing, you know. And I didn't think it was anything unusual, somebody making a living out of used feathers. But when I think about it, who made the revolution in retail? In America, in England, in France, in Italy, in Germany, Jews. You know, the big department stores. Who started popular culture, Tin Pan Alley? Jews. Movie industry? Jews. Once it gets started, they're out of it, by the way. It gets bought up by corporate. They move disproportionately in science-based industries, disproportionately in the niche services. You know, always on the forefront. So you see this also economically. You see it culturally, too. You see it philosophically. If you talk about the people who had the most revolutionary impact the last 200 years, well, there's Marx, there's Freud, there's Einstein, you know. Hello, anybody else? There's always this, and it's, I think, you know, I'm not like the Lobovichers that think we racially have this racial superiority of the spark or anything. It's just part of who we are, what we grow up in, and what is special, and what is fun about us. I think it's fun to be Jewish. It's amusing.
Sure is.
I grew up in Philadelphia, and I was watching these Walt Disney movies, and I wanted to see, okay, my high school is 80% Jewish. So I wanted to go to a Goyesha. I went to school. I went to the small Goyesha College in Ohio. I was one of 11 Jews.
Which
on
one?
The, no, I went to Hiram College in Ohio.
Yeah.
Very nice school.
Small liberal arts college.
Yeah, small liberal arts college outside of Cleveland. And I left after a year, and people asked me why. I said, well, I found, because I had this Ozzie and Harriet picket white fence that the Goyim are healthier than we are. And, you know, I was almost like a Zionist, you know, like the Goyim are healthier than we are. And I came back home, and the people said, well, look, I found out that they're just as screwed up as we are and nowhere near as funny. You hardly ever laugh.
No,
it's not even entertainment.
Humor.
I can't explain it. It's like this. It's not quick.
It's certainly quick here. We're moving.
I like it.
I love it.
Yeah.
I wanted to regress for a moment.
Okay.
How do you see the ending of this conflict with the Arab world? I take it that that's part of what you see later down the line.
Look, I talk about it in the chapter. You have to neutralize two problems. You have to neutralize the refugee problem. You can't do that as long as your UNRWA still exists. You know, it's the only refugee problem since World War II that has its own...
Mm-hmm.
Its own agency. Everything else was under the High Commission for Refugees of the United Nations. You had 19 million refugees in the partition of India and Pakistan. There's no refugees. You had 8 million German refugees, 3 million from the Sudetenland, forcibly ethnically cleansed out of Poland. You know, they're still not around. So you have to, because they're not coming back. They can talk about the right of return all they want.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once they have Palestine, they can have a law of return. That's their business. Gesinnt Heil. Most of them won't want to go back. That's a whole different story. But they're not coming back. As long as this myth is there, it's bad. So that has to be neutralized. This is something that Europe could finance the resettlement or whatever. We have to neutralize the settler problem, these isolated settlements. So you can buy them out too. Half of them would be bought out tomorrow. The ones that are not ideological, tomorrow you could buy them out. They'd be out.
That was part of Barak's program, which I thought was marvelous.
Yeah. So those are certain things you can do. Then you have to recognize limitations. You're not going to have a finalistic peace with the Palestinians as they are now. But you can have a hudna. Now, a hudna can last 10 years. 10 years is good. Every time we've had a quiet period, by the way, with them. Now, worst possible scenario, they start something again after 10 years. But during the 10 years, every time we've had a quiet period, we've always developed much better than they have. You know, between the Independence War and the Sinai Campaign, between the Sinai Campaign and 67, 67 to 73, between 91 Madrid and 2000, the outbreak of the Second Intifada, my God, we absorbed 1 million new immigrants. We grew by 40%. We became Silicon Valley, you know. So I say, let's do what we can do and not talk about pie in the sky kind of stuff and create a reality. You have to create a reality, halacha lemaaseh. You have to create a reality as a process. And I believe that, you know, that history has its own way of wearing these things out. But you have to help it. You can't antagonize it. And we've been antagonizing it also, not only them. I mean, they antagonize it by blowing up buses. I'm not making a comparison. You know, we do stuff that we shouldn't be doing also. Of course, we have the right to do it. You know something? You grew up in New York. You know, you have the right, the constitutional right, to walk through the South Bronx at 2 in the morning counting $100 bills?
Absolutely.
It's an absolute constitutional right.
Absolutely.
If you do it, you're an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
A dead idiot, but...
We should be dead.
Probably,
yes. It's probably a Darwinian thing. When somebody does that, should be dead, you know.
Right.
I mean, you know, just because you have the right to do something doesn't mean... Now, isn't this... There's stuff in the Talmud about things like this, too, by the way. If you want to lose... You know, be careful about being overly righteous, you know. There's all sorts of stuff like this about using your righteousness. Yeah, you're right. Okay. I had the right of way. I'm dead, but I had the right of way. I'm a defensive driver. I have the right of way. You're an idiot. I'll give you the... You know, and... Translate that into politics. In the book, I quote this Admiral de Riebeck in the Gallipoli campaign. He says, brave chaps, those soldiers. You know, they're always going for the thickest part of the fence. So I say, you know, what we've done, we're always obligating our diplomatic efforts to go to the thickest part of the fence, where we have the least chance of explaining ourselves. Because we have the right to do it? Okay, we have the right to. Ben-Gurion, it was in this conversation that I had with him, I don't remember, or I read it. He said something following. We have the absolute right to the entire land of Israel. It's an absolute right. And we have the absolute right not to realize that right or not to exercise that right as long as it interferes with other rights and obligations and needs of the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. And I said, that transcends the whole argument.
Okay, that's a wonderful
we
quote.
We have the right. I think, okay, we have the right. Yeah, so I have the right to jump off a building, too. I mean, we're going to do it. There's something called seichel, which we used to have.
I guess we also have the right to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've exercised that right fully. Well, I think we've covered most of it. I think we'll have to do some more.
We'd love to hear your comments about part one and part two with Zvi Bisk. And we hope that you will... take a look at his new book that's coming out real soon called The Optimistic Jew, A Positive View of Jewish Life in the 21st Century. And also, if you want further information about him and his work, you can find it on his website at www.futurist-thinking.co.il. That's www.futurist-thinking.co.il. For Yoram, this is Steve Shavua Tov. Have a great week.